And we're live. What's up, everybody? Thank you all for joining us. We're back with the Zacks. Two Zacks, both Jewish. One a Zionist, the other an anti-Zionist. I would say this is probably our fifth time doing this, the three of us. Fifth, yeah. And I'll say we'll give it two more times for you guys to work out your differences, and then we're done here, okay?
That's it.
Great to have you both back. Whoever's viewing, great to see you all. Before we get started, just, you know, a shout out to all our patrons and all our supporters. If you want to support the show, you can find how to do that in the description. This support really helps us take what we're doing to the next level. We're in the process of hiring a few employees to really grow the channel, grow our reach, and really, you know, show the world what it means to reconcile between people in conflict through respectful dialogue. So that's what we're here to do. Let's get the show on the road. So we are now almost a month since the attacks on October 7th. How do we get here? How do we get to this point? Zach Foster, we'll start with you.
How did we get to October 7th? I think for me, the story starts first in 1948, then in 1967, then in 2007. Those are the three turning points over the past 75 years, and let me briefly go through each one. In 1948, Zionists and then Israelis expelled 750,000 Palestinians from their homes and then shot at anyone who tried to return to their homes in the year and a half after the war. In fact, in 1949, 1950, Israel slaughtered more than 1,000 armless, defenseless Palestinians returning to their home after a war. And I think even to understand how we got to October 7th, you have to understand that 75% of the people living in Gaza as of October 6th were refugees from that war or their descendants. So you're dealing with a population who never believed they lost the right to live in Palestine. The population never lost the belief that they have a right to live in Palestine, even though they were violently ethnically cleansed from it. So I think that's the first thing to say. So I think the next major turning point in trying to understand how we got to where we got to today is 1967. Israel occupies Gaza, the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and other parts in Sinai and the Golan Heights. And from 1967 to 1987, Israel is militarily occupying the West Bank and Gaza, and on average kills 32 Palestinians every year for 20 years, kills 630 Palestinians over the course of those 20 years. This is before the rise of Hamas. This is before there are rockets flying into Israel. This is before there are any terrorists in Gaza or the West Bank, by Israel's own admission. And so it's a brutal military occupation. In 1986, there's an interesting poll that is conducted in which Palestinians are asked, a thousand people are polled in 86, and 50% of them report being harassed or physically abused at checkpoints. More than 50% of them, 20% have their homes demolished or sealed. 30% are prevented from leaving abroad. Many report being a political arrest, something like 40-50% report political arrest. So basically, you have this brutal military occupation, which Palestinians are being abused, harassed, killed, arrested, detained. This leads to the outbreak of the first Intifada in 1987, in which there's a spontaneous uprising, overwhelmingly nonviolent, especially initially. In the first year, Israel slaughters 142 Palestinians in Gaza. Gazans kill zero Israelis. That radicalizes organizations that were previously charity organizations like Hamas, who turned to violence. And then, the Palestinians in Gaza increasingly over the 90s turned to violence as a result of Israel's brutal suppression. In fact, you don't even have the first Hamas attack on civilians until December 1990. Okay, which is in response to a protest in October 1990, in which Israel slaughtered 22 defenseless Palestinians. So that radicalizes Hamas even further. But even it's not really until 1994 when Hamas really embraces violence. Why? Baruch Goldstein enters the Ibrahimi Mosque in Hebron and slaughters 29 Palestinian worshippers in a massacre. That radicalizes Hamas even further. And so it's really not until the late 90s, from 94 to 2000, that Hamas really fully embraces violence. And then I think really to fully understand and appreciate how we got to where we got to today, Hamas obviously takes power in Gaza and they win the January 26 elections and democratic elections, free and fair elections, and the international community although apparently believes in democracy, just doesn't believe in democracy when it doesn't like the result. And so, you know, the international community, together with Israel, imposes this land, sea, and air blockade on Gaza. And so for the past 16 years, from 2007, when Hamas took power in Gaza, to the present, Israel has imposed a suffocating blockade and siege that leads to the death of thousands of innocent Palestinians over the course of that 16-year period. It has also waged five wars on the Gaza Strip. In 2008, it killed 1,000 innocent Palestinian civilians. In 2014, it killed 1,500 innocent Palestinian civilians. In 2018, it slaughtered Palestinian defenseless protesters, nonviolent protesters, chanting, marching to the wall in the Great March of Return, killed 250 Palestinians during that protest. So, and then in 2021, again, it waged another assault on Gaza and killed another 100 Palestinian civilians, 250 Palestinians total. So you've got five wars waged on Gaza. You have 16 years of blockade and siege on Gaza, always illegal because it's punishing innocent civilians who took no part in the hostilities, who do not even support Hamas, who were kids at the time Hamas was elected or were unborn at the time that Hamas was elected. So a brutal 16-year military siege, 56 years of occupation, and 75 years of displacement as a result of the creation of the refugee problem by Israel in 1948. And I think it really, to understand October 7th, you need to understand that entire history.
Thank you, anti-Zionist Zach. Zionist Zach, the floor is yours.
Just real quick, I want to thank Adar for having me on again and for my debate partner and friend, Zach Foster, for being here. You know, if you ask the Palestinians about the start of the conflict and why they're so upset with Zionist Jews, they will tell you. They're very open about it in their explicit statements. They write about it in their charters, in Hamas's charter. It's written in the PLO charters of 1964 and 1968. You will find it in online resources like the BDS website, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions. You will find it in a popular, though very poorly written resource that's I've seen called Decolonize Palestine. And they all give the same origin point of the conflict, and that is around 1918-1920, when the Balfour Declaration is issued. And the presence of Jews as a political body is recognized by, at first, the British imperial power, and then ultimately the international community. That is the origin point of the conflict. It is not the blockade of Gaza, because there was Palestinian violence before the blockade of Gaza. It is not 1967 and the occupation, because there was Palestinian violence before that. Nor is it 1948, the Nakba, because, you know, there were the events of Hebron in 1921 and the uprising in 1936 and 1921. The point of origin is when Jews begin to arrive in large number and when they are recognized as being an independent political community in Palestine. Right. The problem with the Jews in Israel is not the Israeli state, but rather is the presence of a settler colonial community of Jews. And when you say that somebody is a settler, you are saying that they have an alien, that they are aliens, and that they have no right to belong in that community. Right. It's like the Palestinian chant goes, colonizer, colonizer, go home. This is our home, our, referring to the ethnic indigenous Palestinian people. The land belongs to the Palestinians and the Jews have no part in it. One popular mashal or metaphor that the Palestinians use is that Palestine is their home and the Jews are squatters in their home. So imagine you have a home, you're living in, you know, it's a two-story home, you go on vacation, you come back, and there's somebody living in the second floor of that home. And imagine, you know, you get very upset at them, you say, this is not fair. And they say, okay, you know, let's do this. I'll have the second floor of the home, you'll have the first floor of the home, and we'll split the home. You say, no, that's not fair. This is my home. And they say, okay, okay, I understand, that's a problem, you want to go upstairs. So let's do it like this. Let's both live in the home and we'll share the home. And they'll say, no, that's not fair either. This is not your home. You are squatters in the land. You are Europeans. There's no such thing as the Jewish people. The land belongs to the Palestinians, and to the Palestinians it must return. When we talk about the return of the refugees, there's a lot of very confusing Palestinian phrases that need to be contextualized. Return of the refugees does not refer to the return of the refugees to the land of Palestine. Rather, it refers to the return of Palestine to the refugees and to the people. So that is the fundamental issue here, that the Palestinian people have never accepted the presence of Jews in any arrangement, not in two states, not in one state. Jews are settler colonials. Jews do not belong, and Jews have to leave. I have one last point, and then I'll turn it back over. The operative phrase that we kept hearing from Zach over and over again was in response to, right? Hamas's violence is in response to. Palestinian violence is in response to, right? Now, if I were to ask Zach, do you support Hamas's terrorism on October 7th, he would say no. And I know he doesn't support it. He doesn't support it. He doesn't justify it, but he explains it. Palestinian violence to the left always needs an explanation, not a justification, though a recent poll said that 51% of 18 to 24-year-olds fully justify Hamas's assault. Putting that to the side, Palestinian violence always needs an explanation. There must be something that caused it. There must be some sort of act of oppression that came before. Palestinians only strike when they are struck. And intellectuals like Peter Beinart will put it this way. He'll say, well, you know, all people are violent when they are oppressed. And you say, okay, well then, how come Israelis act violently? And they don't really have an answer to this question. You know, again, if all people choose violence when they're oppressed, well, then who acted violently to the Israelis? And so basically what the left has done is they have split the human race into two groups. There are the pure, holy, indigenous Palestinians, and there are the wicked and impure and vicious and aggressive Jews and white people. Palestinian violence is reactive. There's always something that comes before. Palestinians are naturally peaceful. If you look at some of the Palestinian mythology, the writing about the history of Palestine before the Zionists got there, you'll see that there's very little written. And there's very little written because history is the record of violent acts between people. It is the record of oppression, of battle, of conflict. Before the Zionists arrived, there was no conflict. Palestinians and Jews and Muslims and Christians coexisted perfectly until the white settler colonial Jews showed up and paradise was lost. This is the myth, the racial myth that drives Foster's thinking and the thinking of the rest of the left.
That's a great point that you left off on there, Zach. Unless you wanted to jump in, Adar, I'm happy to respond to some of those points.
Take it away.
Yeah, so that's great. I'm really glad you brought us back to Adam and Palestine before Zionism, because that is really my bread and butter, and I love talking about that. On the eve of Zionist immigration, Jews, Muslims, and Christians lived in Palestine in relative peace for many, many decades. And I think zooming out even further, Jews obviously fared better under Muslim rule than they did Christian rule. And I can't think of a serious historian who would disagree with that point. But let's zoom in back on into Ottoman Palestine. So in Jerusalem in the 1870s, 80s, and 90s, right before Zionism has left its mark on Palestine, you had Jews and Muslims living in the same buildings. Their kids were playing in the same courtyards in the old city of Jerusalem. You had Jews and Palestinian Arabs living on the same streets in Manchiya, which was a suburb of Jaffa. You had Jews celebrating Ramadan together with Muslims. You had Christians and Muslims dressing up on Purim, celebrating Purim with Jews. In places like Sheikh Jarrah, you had Muslims accompanying Jews on picnics to celebrate Jewish holidays together. The same Sheikh Jarrah, where today there's an effort to ethnically cleanse dozens and dozens of Palestinian families from that neighborhood. Okay, so I'm not here to tell you that there weren't zero problems in Ottoman Palestine. I'm not here to tell you that the Ottoman Empire treated all religions equally. That's not what I'm saying. What I am saying, though, is that things didn't have to turn out the way they did. There was a certain amount of coexistence. There was a certain amount of acceptance across religious boundaries. And I might even go so far as to say that by the early 20th century, in many places, especially among the elite, especially among the intellectuals, the fault line was not necessarily Jewish, Muslim, Christian. The fault line may have been whether you were an Ottomanist, who supported centralization of the empire, or an Ottomanist who supported decentralization. And so you had many, for example, the editors of the Palestinian newspaper Philistine in 1911. So we're talking 20 years into the Zionist colonization of Palestine. You know, and by the way, they use the word colonization of Palestine, so I'm just using their language. But you had in 1911, the editors of the Palestinian newspaper Philistine, the Issa cousins, they hired and paid for a Jewish Zionist to write for the newspaper. Out of their shared desire and their shared belief, to try to bring modernity to Palestine. They hired this Jewish writer who was writing all about the Palestinian peasantry and how, you know, they need to adopt modern techniques of agriculture and they need to embrace modern ideas like democracy, like constitutionalism, like development. So they had this shared vision of an Ottoman future, of Ottoman loyalty, of that we're all in this as Ottomans together. And again, I think the reason I'm talking about this is because In a framework in which Jews and Muslims and Christians, in which Jews and Muslims all believe in a shared political vision that is an Ottoman state with an Ottoman identity and Ottoman symbols, you know, and an Ottoman future, Jews and Muslims actually were able to live in peace together. It was only when you had Zionists come and say, we don't want an Ottoman state. We want a Jewish state. We don't want a state that tries to include all of the subjects and all of the religious communities. Instead, we want a state that privileges one community over all the others. And that's what Zionism was. It was, and so that's why every Zionist leader from the 1880s to 1948, they all asked themselves the same question. And literally, we're talking about almost every Zionist had an opinion about this question because they had to, which is how do you establish a Jewish state in a land that is overwhelmingly non-Jewish? Because they all had to confront that question. Theodor Herzl answered that question in his diary already in the 1890s and said, we're going to have to probably expel them. Ahad Ha'am had to ask himself that question. Israel Zengel had to ask himself that question. Arthur Rupin, Smolansky, Yosef Weitz, Chaim Weizmann, Ben-Gurion, Moshe Shertok, they all asked themselves the same question, and most of them came back with and most of them replied to that question and answered that question and said, we're probably going to have to expel them. Some believed that maybe they would leave voluntarily. Some believed that because of Zionist ingenuity, that they would happily live in the Zionist paradise because of all the benefits Zionists would bring them. But most of them believed ultimately in transfer, either voluntary or forceful. And I think kind of that is ultimately what you have to understand about the core, I would say, struggle among Zionist leaders throughout the late 30s and 40s was, if we really want to establish a Jewish state, what are we going to do with the fact that most of the people that are going to be in this Jewish state are Palestinian and they're not willing to accept a Jewish domination? They have a strong identity. They have a strong national identity. They have strong roots in the country. And so they're not willing to accept being subject to Jewish domination. And so I think that's really the key to understanding kind of Zionist history, really from the 1880s to 1948. I also want to address one other point, which is this question of kind of, you know, you're talking about, you know, reaction, you know, actions and reactions, like who started it, right? Like, you know, I'm talking about how these are always responses to, Jewish violence. In 1919, the Palestinians organized a national congress, and they organized six or seven of them throughout the 1920s. And in each of those congresses, they state something to the effect of, we are open to, we want to establish a democratic state whose representatives would be elected by the Jewish, Muslim, and Christian inhabitants of Palestine before World War I. That is basically the position of the organized Palestinian political community in Palestine in the 1920s. They were pro-democracy. They supported the right for Jews to vote in that state. They did not support the right for Zionist settlers to vote in the state, who had arrived there illegally, in their view, because the British imposed this mandate on them against their own democratic will. Right? I mean, recall that the only reason Zionism was able to prosper in the first place was owing to British colonial rule in Palestine, which was fundamentally anti-democratic. Right? Palestinians were asked in 1919 by the King Crane Commission, do you support a Zionist program in Palestine? 85% of people said no. But it didn't matter. The British didn't care. And so they imposed British rule on Palestine, and they facilitated Zionist immigration to Palestine and Zionist land purchases in Palestine. And all that was fundamentally anti-democratic. And I think when you begin to realize that the core principle of Zionism is not democracy. In fact, the core principle of Zionism is actually anti-democracy, because at any point from 1920 to 1930 to 1940, you know, all the way to 1948, the Zionists could never accept democracy, because democracy meant they would be in the minority. And so Zionists always supported anti-democracy. The way they justified it was nationalism, which was a fundamentally anti-democratic movement, which says the legitimacy of your claim to statehood is not based on the majority of the people that live in that state. What do they think? The Zionists rejected that view. That was the Palestinian view. The Zionists said, the legitimacy of my claim to statehood is based on my claim to nationhood. And if I have a claim to nationhood, therefore I have a claim to statehood. And I think whereas the Palestinians said, no, my claim to statehood is based on the democratic will of the people that live in this state. And I really think, kind of, if you understand that, you know, basically Zionists rejected democracy and Palestinians supported democracy. Again, like I said, in that early period, you wanted to bring this back to 1920. And so I think if you understand that principle, you understand a key to understanding the core reason why Palestinians feel, I think, why that they felt like, you know, Zionist immigration was illegal and fundamentally unethical.
Well, Zach, real quick before you jump in. Sure. We just have a new paying member. So shout out to Sarah. Thank you for the support. And if anybody else wants to, you can click that join button and support, or find more info in the description. Real quick, Zach, before you answer, I just don't want us to get caught too much on history and what the land was prior to Jews arriving here. And the reason for this is, even if we could look back and see that things could have been done differently, and I certainly agree things could have been done differently, there really is no going back, right? We are where we are, and it's a question of moving forward. And many often look at, like, the relative peace we had amongst the different ethnic and religious groups living on the land, and that's a sign that we could just recreate that instantly. But the thing is, after 100 years of conflict, there is no going back, and we can't recreate the same system and world we were living in then, certainly not overnight, within generations perhaps. But I just don't want us to get stuck in the fantasy of the past and get bogged down there. I'd rather us talk about the present and what we can do moving forward. So Zach, feel free to comment.
Yeah, just real quick. I agree that by a medieval standard, the Jews were treated well in pre-Ottoman Palestine, but that's not the standard that Israel is subjected to. And that's not the standard that we should subject that period to. Compared to a modern standard, modern America, let's say past the civil rights movement, Sweden, Denmark, Germany, France, Jews did not have equality with Palestinians. Now, were there moments, heartwarming moments of coexistence? I'm sure there were. I lived in Israel for 10 years. I could share many heartwarming moments. I remember being in the army with a Muslim soldier. And when the settlement found out that there was a Muslim soldier in our brigade, they immediately started inviting him every Friday night to turn on their lights. And to turn on things that they forgot to turn on before Shabbat. He became a Shabbos goy. And every week he came home with a big thing of food from the settlement, because he was a non-Jew and non-Jews are able to turn on the lights on Shabbat. I could tell you wonderful stories about Tel Aviv University with the coexistence between the mostly female Palestinian bodybuilders and lifters and the male trainers and how wonderful the friendships were in the social circle. And I could tell you about Mansour Abbas, who's a wonderful leader, who was part of the last government, who if I was in Israel, I would have happily voted for. And Zach, you would have dismissed this all as Hasbara and Zionist propaganda. It's not enough to compare your political community to the Germany of 1387. And it's not enough to come up with some stories of coexistence between peoples. In terms of the present, we have to ask, well, what sort of idea can we build a state on? What sort of idea can we base things on in order to have peace? And let me just point out that that framework is an extremely Jewish way, and might I say a Zionist way, of looking at the conflict. And I will just say that all three people here are Jewish and that we have no Palestinian representation on this platform. Because Palestinians, and I've heard, I could go through names, but I've heard them, both personal acquaintances and on Twitter and in their articles, they are not talking about peace. They are talking about justice. So the whole framework of how can we achieve peace is a very Jewish one. Whether you are on the right or in the center or on the left, or as my friend Zach is on the far left, that is a very, very Jewish way of looking at things. Now, on the question of right now, and what sort of idea can we build a state on? I agree that you cannot create true democracy on the idea of Jewish solidarity or on the idea of Jewish peoplehood. And there is no argument that I have heard, that I've found persuasive, that convinces me that it's okay for Jews to have an ethnic state. And in fact, there are, I see some loyal listeners, you may recall that the last conversation we had, the fourth conversation, was not Zionist versus anti-Zionist, but was basically anti-Zionist talks to another anti-Zionist, because I see no moral justification for a Jewish state. Just like I don't see any moral justification for a Franco-Aryan state in France, or a Lutheran Aryan state in Germany, or a Scandinavian state in Sweden. That cannot serve as a basis for democracy, but neither can the idea that the Jews are settler colonials. There cannot be equality and peace, or let's just start with equality. There cannot be equality between people who belong and people who don't belong. In order to have equality, there has to be this idea of belonging. That is the premise. That is the basis on which equality is built. And when you say that people who are descended from those who arrived after 1920 and the promulgation of the Balfour Declaration, when you say that the settler colonial status is inherited racially, that I'm a settler colonial, my children will be a settler colonial, that Israelis going back four and five generations, there is no basis for democracy. And very often we hear this absurd comparison between the Palestinians and Martin Luther King and Black Americans and Nelson Mandela and Black South Africans. Mandela and Martin Luther King and the movements that they represented never claimed to be waging a campaign of decolonization. They were waging an anti-apartheid campaign for integration and equality. They said, we want to send our kids to the same schools that you send your children to. We want to drink from the same water fountains. We want to swim in the same pools. We want to hit on the same girls when we go out to clubs. That was the basis of their civil rights movement. The Palestinians are not asking for that. The Palestinians are not waging an anti-apartheid campaign, as much as they use that word. The Palestinians are waging a campaign of decolonization. Now, if colonization means the movement of people into an area, then decolonization must mean the movement of people out of the area. Palestinians do not recognize Jewish belonging in the land. And until they do, there will only be war. A society really has one of two choices in terms of the values that it champions and the path that it chooses. One society or one path is to value the dreams of your children. We hear a lot about, you know, the dreams of gods and children who have been killed, some of them probably murdered for no reason by Israel, and who are lying under the rubble. That's one society. That's a society that looks towards the future and a society that believes in peace. But there's another sort of society, and that is a society that values the struggles of past generations. And that is the sort of society that Palestine is. They fight today because their fathers fought yesterday. They die today because their brothers fought and died yesterday. That is a society that is committed to war. It's not that they don't value their children. Of course they love their kids. Of course they do. But again, you can only choose one of these paths. And that is the path that they have chosen. We here are liberal people, and we want them to choose peace. But my attitude has always been, and this is the liberal attitude, that those who love the living should stop fighting the wars of the dead. That is what the Palestinians are fighting for. They're fighting, and you look at the hell that we've put them through, and it's hell. But to the Palestinians, the only hell worse than right now is living in peace with Israel. And it's hard to believe, and it's hard to empathize with that sentiment, but I think you can. If you understand, if you can empathize with the phrase that it is better to die as a free man than it is to live as a slave, I think you can get into the Palestinian psyche. For them, peace, whether it be two states or one state, is slavery.
Let me chime in here real quick. Go ahead. Because Zach, to your point, you know, I personally think one of the single best ways to improve the lives of Palestinians is for them to come to terms with the existence of a Jewish state on part of this land. And the best thing Israel could do is to transform the state to make it easier for Palestinians to accept. Right? If we're to really simplify what each side can do to really bring us closer to a peaceful resolution. But just on another point. I actually think there is certainly a way to justify an ethno-state or a state that has certain national ethnic qualities. And that's really, you know, the fact that you have two distinct ethnic and religious groups living on this land that both have a desire to self-determine, and they want to self-determine distinctly. And these two ethnic groups have been in conflict with each other for 100 years. So to give both populations sovereignty over some part of the land and allow them to self-determine in a way that is suitable for them very well may end up in two, whether it's states or cantons or whatever configuration we want, that has certain national ethnic features. And I think that's perfectly fine because it solves a conflict. So I don't see an ethno-state as the worst thing in the world if it stops bloodshed and allows for self-determination of the people living on the land.
Well, I would just quickly, it doesn't solve the conflict. There is no solution to the conflict because a solution means that everybody gets what they want, and that's impossible. I mean, maybe if we could like copy the world and there could be two planet Earths, and then, you know, in one world we give the Jews all of Israel, and then the other world we give all of the Palestinians. You're talking about peace, and peace is possible, though, you know, not only in two states. There could also be a single all Jewish state and a single all-Palestinian state. That would certainly solve the conflict if solution means here an end to fighting. But every configuration involves injustice, and Palestinians are not willing to bear that injustice.
I think Zach Foster, chime in.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, in the past few weeks, a lot of people in a lot of different interviews have always keep asking the same question, which is, what's the solution? I just really dislike that question because I think that the better question to be asking is, what are the next 3 or 4 or 5 things that need to happen today and tomorrow and next week and next month to get us to a place where we can even start to talk about what a solution might look like in a year or 2 or 3 from now. But we are so far removed. I mean, to be talking about a solution when there are hundreds of Palestinians being slaughtered every single day is just kind of disconnected from the reality, which is the solution to the problem right now is a ceasefire and opening up the opening up Gaza so that people are can stop dying from dehydration and hunger. I mean, the reports coming out of Gaza are apocalyptic. The people are literally dying from dehydration right now. And we're talking about one state, two state. I mean, it's just so disconnected from the reality, right? So I think the first step is you need to stop bombing Gaza. And, you know, already there, we're at a point where the overwhelming majority of the Israeli public would be completely hostile to that point. But you're talking about an Israeli public that is so hell-bent, that is so hungry and thirsty for Palestinian blood right now, that has repeated time and time again that all of Gaza support Hamas, therefore you can kill them all, which is, by the way, not even in the international law, you know, a civilian who supports a government that you may not like, that you may call a terrorist organization, is still a civilian, and it is still unlawful to kill them under international law. It is still unlawful to deny them food and water and electricity and fuel. So you're talking about an Israeli public that believes in the indiscriminate slaughter of 2 million people, that believes it is justified to cut off fresh drinking water to 2.3 million people. I mean, talking about a one-state solution or a two-state solution or giving people national rights. I mean, we're literally talking about 10 million Israelis that essentially support a genocidal campaign on 2.3 million people. I mean, the solution right now is to get Israelis to realize that 2.3 million people are civilians and that those civilians should not be indiscriminately slaughtered and should not be subject to hunger and starvation and dehydration. And how do we convince Israelis to even get to that point?
Well, Zach, so interestingly, one of the best ways to convince Israelis is to give them a vision of the future, which actually involves talking about solutions. The reason there's such a broad consensus amongst the Israeli population, from the right to the left, that no matter what, Hamas needs to be defeated. Most Israelis don't like to see innocent Palestinians die. It's true that the number of Israelis that have no problem with that certainly increased after October 7th. But that's not what motivates Israelis. It's wanting to be safe. It's not wanting to be attacked. It's not wanting to see another massacre happen. So we could say ceasefire all day long, but we need to say what happens the day after the ceasefire. And this comes with really planning the future. So we could tweet all we want. We could yell all we want. What's next? And if we can't say the what's next, Israelis are not going to support it. So I'm very happy to talk about what's next, but that does involve solutions.
Do you mind if I hop in, Zach?
Please.
I thought that was a good transition from history to the present. In terms of what I think a lot of Israelis would find acceptable right now, it would be the unconditional surrender of Hamas, the exile of their political leadership and their soldiers, the return of the hostages, and in exchange for those hostages, though I don't see this happening, I would empty out all of Israel's prisons. I would give back all of the political prisoners, the Hamasniks and whoever else, and send them on the same boat that I'm sending Hamas to a non-neighboring country, Iraq, Algeria, Tunisia, Iran, Qatar. That would be fine to me, and that could end the war. In terms of food and water, there's really very little justification for the siege itself. It's not helping Israel's effort to extend the war as long as possible. It's going to take at least another 2 to 3 weeks to get through the north. I don't see how they go to the south, but that would take another month. And the denial of basic necessities, food, water, medicine, is a major mistake and is hurting Israel internationally and is undertaken from revenge. I don't have any starry-eyed view of the Israeli public. I was in the Israeli military. I used to be religious. I walked in these circles. There's a lot of racism in Israel. There are a lot of Israelis who are out for blood, though I think as a Jew speaking publicly, you should refrain from using such language. In the Israeli military, it was perfectly fine to be an out-and-out homosexual, even around other religious men. Nobody really cared. There was the gay guy. That was fine. But if you were a leftist, you better stay in the closet on that. Okay. Talk about your boyfriend all you want at the shooting range, but don't talk about your Palestinian girlfriend. That would have gotten you into major trouble. So I don't see the Israeli public be rosy-eyed at all. Now, in terms of Israel's war effort, I am different than most, I guess, anti-Zionists in that I am totally sympathetic to Israel. I feel that the Israeli response outside of the denial of food, water, and medicine is entirely appropriate. There are a lot of people dying. It's a tragedy. Two wrongs don't make a right, but it certainly creates necessity. And, you know, what else can Israel do? There are some serious people on the left who have suggested things like Zach Buchamp and Ezra Klein, other Jews who have said that Israel should send commandos into the tunnels to kill Yahya Sinwar and the rest of the Hamas terribles. Let me say that I understand where that's coming from morally, but there's no chance that that happens. We are not going to sacrifice a generation of our finest young men, even in uniform, because Hamas intentionally embeds its civilian infrastructure, both within civilian infrastructure and below it. I mean, their command center is at the Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza.
There's no evidence to support that. I don't know why you're regurgitating Israeli military propaganda.
Well, I'm an Israeli propagandist. What else am I going to regurgitate? So, you know, look, it's clear that Hamas embeds its infrastructure within it. And let me be fair. If Hamas started launching rockets at Israel military bases, and those bases, let's say like Tel HaShomer, which is right near, you know, if Hamas launched an accurate rocket and it slightly went off and hit a civilian house, at this point, I would probably say that's okay. You know, and we have been telling you, we meaning the moderate left, that Palestinian resistance is suicidal and that it's a really, really bad idea to send men into Israel to kill children and fathers and grandmas and to video record the whole thing. I mean, what did you think the reaction was going to be? You knew the reaction was going to be ferocious. You knew it was going to be over the top. You know, it's like you guys say, well, there's this horrible dragon living, you know, over there in a cave. I have a really great idea. Why don't you go into the cave while the dragon is sleeping? Kill a couple of its hatchlings, record it, and then send that video to the dragon. Oh no, you mean the dragon came out of the cave and started breathing fire on your villages? Where can this all end? And there's this bizarre paradox. So on the one hand, you say that Israel is bloodthirsty, it's monstrous, it's villainous, it's apartheid, it's genocidal. But on the other hand, you expect Israel to uphold the strictest and most impossible interpretation of human rights. Whether you believe in Palestinian rights or not, whether you're sympathetic as Zach is, or you're less sympathetic like I am, we have to begin a pragmatic conversation about where resistance leads and why it's not a good idea. Because if this is the genocide of Gaza, and I don't accept that language, and that really isn't fair to call it. Now, the death total is fake. I just want your reaction. Not that the number is fake. No, you see, I got you. Not that the number is fake. I believe the number. And the number is probably high. What are these?
Probably things? Much 20, higher. 000? I mean, there's still thousands of Palestinians trapped under rubble.
Let's say 20,000. It's fake because it doesn't distinguish between the number of civilians killed versus the number of militants. I mean, or
they're
terrorists.
Almost all civilians. They're almost all civilians.
I see that.
Let me ask you a question, Zach. A few days ago, there was an interview on CNN in which an Israeli military spokesperson was asked, is it justified to kill 400, 500 Palestinians in an attack that is targeting a single Hamas command leader? And he said, that's the price of war. He said, yes. I mean, what is the difference between that and what Hamas did on October 7th?
Because if Hamas had positioned its military bases away from civilians.
This isn't a base. This is one person.
I think, let me try to bring clarity here, and we could discuss the moral differences, but there's a difference between intention, who you're targeting, and then those who die as a result of collateral damage, right? So the attacks on October 7th, a lot of those killed were military, right? So I think around 300 of the 1,400 killed were military. So there was an attempt to attack soldiers as well. That is war, even call it fair game. But then around 700 to 900 were directly targeting civilians. The intention there was to attack civilians. The response of Israel is to attack Hamas, Hamas being heavily embedded within civilian infrastructure. Many Palestinians, and I agree with you, the majority of those killed are civilians on the Palestinian side. They're dying as collateral damage. It's not that in the military command post, they're saying, okay, we're going to...
False. We know that, That's false. The stated goal is damage, not precision. That was Israeli military spokesperson saying
Hold on. I recognize that.
Yeah.
Damage to infrastructure, not to life. And again,
that's ridiculous.
I'm not even making a moral claim. I'm trying to break down just the difference, and then we can have a conversation about the morality of it. Okay. Israel's intention is not to maximize civilian casualties, because if they did, we'd see a much, much higher number. Israel dropped around 10,000 bombs on Gaza, and there's around 10,000 killed. So imagine dropping 10,000 bombs on a very heavily, densely populated city and killing one person per bomb. The only way you could achieve that, that's a military feat that you could only achieve if you're trying to reduce civilian casualties. So the way Israel looks at it is, how do we create maximum infrastructural damage, and how do we create as much damage to Hamas as possible? Now, in causing
food,
damage...
Food, water, and electricity to 2.3 million people is damaging who?
It's damaging Hamas and its collective punishment to all Palestinians. But again, I'm giving an assessment, and then you could say if it's justified or not. When Israel attacks a building, they can say, you know what, there's some Hamas infrastructure in there, there's some Hamas members in there, there's also 20 civilians. We're going to do it nonetheless. That is a decision the IDF makes, which we can say that amount of collateral damage is absolutely not justified and immoral. That is a conclusion that can be made. But that is different from saying they are intending to kill civilians. No, they're intending to kill civilians. Of course they are.
But that's ridiculous, though. When you drop a bomb on a civilian neighborhood where hundreds, if not thousands of people are living, the obvious goal is to kill lots of civilians. No, that's obviously not what you're doing.
The goal is to kill militants knowing civilians are going to die.
So you're dropping a bomb knowing civilians are going to die.
You're dropping a bomb knowing you're going to kill civilians.
Yes,
correct.
That's murder. That is illegal.
Okay, listen, guys.
There are two basic principles under the laws of international under the laws of war. Okay, proportionality and distinction. Okay, you are required under international law to distinguish between a military target and a civilian target. If you drop a bomb knowing there are civilians in that building, and it's a disproportionate attack, meaning hundreds of Palestinian civilians will die, even if you kill one militant, you are in violation of the laws of war. You are a criminal, and you should be tried at the ICC for violating the laws of war. And by the way, that has been the case in Gaza for the past 16 years. I mean, you guys don't realize this, but when the entire point of the blockade on Gaza, which kills hundreds, if not thousands of Palestinians every year who die from inability to get medical treatment, inability to access fresh water, inability to access enough food. So Palestinians are dying every year. Okay, as a result of a decision that Israeli military officials made to impose collective punishment, and that was the goal. It was to punish the people. It was not to punish Hamas. The stated goal in 2007 was, we want to punish the civilian population of Gaza for 16 years. For 16 years, we're going to prevent anyone in Gaza from having a normal life. And our stated goal is to punish the people. That is also a war crime. And the goal was to target individual Gazan innocent civilians. And you guys are pretending like the Israeli military is targeting military targets in every single war. In 2008, the Goldstone Report Commission determined that in 11 incidents in which it targeted and in which it killed civilians in military attacks and military strikes, 10 out of the 11 incidents No military target was identified. In other words, 90% of the bombs dropped on Gaza in 2008 were targeting innocent civilians. Their conclusion was the goal of this operation was to terrorize the civilian population of Gaza. Same thing happened in 2014, where the stated goal, where they investigated, where the UN investigated 14 strikes in which innocent civilians were killed. In six out of the 14 strikes, no military targets were identified. The goal was to kill innocent civilians. Same thing happened in 2018 when you had thousands, tens of thousands of innocent Palestinian protesters. They were shot by snipers. They were assassinated. The goal was to kill innocent civilians. And so, now exactly the same thing is happening and you guys are denying it.
Yeah. Yeah. We're not, no one here is denying that innocent civilians are the ones being killed and call it disproportionately and even primarily. What
the goal
we're
was stated
what,
goal was damage. How no, do you state your goal is damage? Zach, the goal, I mean, Bibi Netanyahu, hold on one sec. One last point. Bibi Netanyahu recently came out with a statement telling the Israeli soldiers entering Gaza, we are fighting Amalek. Okay. Now you heard this statement.
That was a dumb speech.
Deuteronomy chapter, was it 28, says, these people are your enemies. You should kill every man, woman, child, cattle, and goats. The goats are terrorists. So you're dealing with a government whose stated aim is to slaughter every single man, woman, and child and animal in Gaza. That, and you guys are saying that, this that, isn't that, targeting that, innocent civilians? That, I mean, give me a fucking break.
That's just not true. And if you say it's true, I want you to be able to answer how there's an average of one death per missile. Because are you saying we're trying to kill more and we just can't? We just drop these massive explosives on densely populated areas and we average one death per missile. So our intention is to really maximize civilian harm.
I'm not saying you're not also targeting military targets. I think you are.
But it's very clear.
It's very clear. It's yes and. When you drop a bomb on a refugee camp and 500 people die in one strike, how can you claim that the goal there was not to commit indiscriminate slaughter? I mean,
I explained it and I'll explain it again. And I don't think, I'm not a professional in international law, and I don't think you are either. But the way on this point, the way international works is collateral damage is actually acceptable in international law if it justifies the strategic gain made, which is highly subjective.
Yeah, yeah. Subjective to the point of, I would say, being meaningless. I mean, that's the problem with proportionality. How do you define it? And just real quick, and I'm sorry if this is patronizing, Zach, but I do want to make the point because there's a lot of Israelis in the chat. We can see Zach's concern. Believe that his concern is based on concern for Palestinian life. I don't, even if he's supportive of Hamas in the end, it's clear that his concern
Who said I support Hamas? Whoever said that.
That does not come from a place of anti-Semitism. That's not, but from a genuine place of concern for the 10,000 lives. I think many of them Hamas soldiers, but anyway, the 10,000 lives, over 4,000 children that Israel has taken.
Yeah, I mean, when you declare that you're going to cut off food, water, and electricity and fuel to 2.3 million people, and you drop bombs that each a single bomb that kills 500 people in a refugee camp, okay, in Jabalia, when you can claim that I'm targeting I don't understand how you can claim that your goal is to target military infrastructure when you drop a bomb on a refugee camp that is home to hundreds and hundreds of innocent Palestinian people.
Did you see it was actually news that came out of it was a Palestinian news source that said after the refugee camp was hit, they saw that buildings were collapsing underground. What they did was hit a refugee camp that was on a tunnel network. So again, this is all the question of proportionality, and you could still, I'm not even saying you can't make the case that this is unjustified and immoral. I'm saying your claim that the target is civilians.
Yeah. Well, there's a bigger problem here, which is that Israel.
Wait, hold on, Zach, real quick.
Yeah.
The intention is maximum harm to infrastructure, Hamas militants, and primarily Hamas infrastructure. And if tens of thousands of civilians need to die along the way, Israel is willing to do that. I would agree with that. You can challenge the morality of that, but I would say that is the correct statement. I mean, to say that they are intentionally trying to kill civilians just isn't really
grounded. This is the fundamental. If you go back in history and look at every military act taken by these by Israel over the past, honestly, I would say 75 years, there's a single doctrine which really defines Israel's military doctrine for 75 years, which is a doctrine of disproportionality. And this was stated by Ben-Gurion. This was stated by Ariel Sharon. This was stated by, obviously, Bibi Netanyahu. It's stated by every leader. And the doctrine is an illegal doctrine because it's literally a it's one of the two principles of international law when it comes to armed conflict, which is, like I said, distinction and proportionality. And if you look at Israel's wars, the goal is basically the stated goal is we will always inflict more destruction and more death on the Palestinians than has been inflicted on us. That is the doctrine that really, if you draw a through line in every conflict, so you're talking about a military whose literal, whose goal, whose stated, honestly, whose vision and whose goal and whose doctrine is a fucking war crime.
But Zach, there's two things you have to understand. One is that Hamas, as has been stated, embeds its civilian infrastructure inside of
I'm not denying any of those things. I'm just telling you this idea that there's no moral equivalency is a lie.
By the way, last time I checked, that's a violation of international
law. But I'm saying, I agree with you on Hamas. I agree with you on that. But you have to concede that Israel is equally complicit in violating international law, just like Hamas is.
But the other point, and this is something that you never bring up. There are two things that you never seem to really even bring into the picture. One of them is power, that this is a power game in the Middle East, and Israel needs to show strength. They need to show that they're like a wounded tiger, or in the words of, I forget, Moshe Dayan, the eye patch, that we are like a rabid dog. If we need to show our neighbors that if they hit us, our reaction will be so crazy. Look at what's happened on the North.
We need to show them that we're willing to slaughter innocent people. I mean, that's the argument you're making.
Look, Nasrallah, who remembers the destruction that Israel inflicted in 2006, has basically declared that he is more or less going to stay on the sidelines. And Israel needs to establish deterrence against its other enemies. Because, you know, if we just pull away, maybe not now, but if after a couple of days of hitting some Hamas posts, we pulled away, we would invite attacks from the North. We're already getting hit now from Yemen. There is a power game going on here that you don't seem to acknowledge.
Well, let's talk. Okay.
I want to put something on the record real quick.
Yeah.
You know, because I'm pushing back on you, but those who have been watching the channel know that every single time there has been a wave of violence between Israel and Hamas, I've avidly spoken against the airstrikes because they're entirely counterproductive. So here I'm taking a stance just on the matter of truth, not so much on opinion. But I will go on to say that if Israel successfully defeats Hamas and can change the status quo and improve the lives not only of Jews but of Palestinians, then I think looking back, we'd see the collateral damage as worth it. The same way we saw, you know, 30,000 dead Germans when Allied forces bombed Germany as worthy collateral damage. That being said, I have been avidly outspoken against these airstrikes because they've done nothing but cause more harm and further radicalize the Palestinian population, strengthen Hamas and isolate Israel. If they do defeat them this time, then perhaps it could be justified. I mean, but go
this
ahead.
This idea of eradicating Hamas, let's just dwell on that for a second, because sure. I do think that is kind of the mainstream view in Israel right now. It's definitely the mainstream view I think all around the world. And so the question is, is there a belief that you can eradicate Palestinian militant resistance? Let's just go a bit into history here, because I think history is very telling. In 1956, during the Suez Crisis, you know, one of Israel's primary goals during that crisis was to eradicate Palestinian militant resistance coming out of Gaza. Remember, this is during the period of the border wars in which you had Fedayeen, Palestinian fighters, coming into Israel, carrying out cross-border raids. And in 1956, Israel's stated goal was when they partnered with Britain and France to in a kind of a neo-colonial war to reoccupy the Suez Canal. Israel's stated goal was to eradicate this Palestinian violent resistance. And in October 1956, the Israeli military entered Gaza. They occupied Gaza for 6 months. and they slaughtered hundreds and hundreds of these fighters. In some cases, there were massacres. In some cases, there were hundreds of Palestinian massacres, okay? And guess what they did? They rooted out most of, perhaps nearly all of the Fedayeen coming out of Gaza. And over the course of the next few years, guess what happened? The Fedayeen carried out attacks from the West Bank. All Israel did was push the Palestinian militants from Gaza to the West Bank. Then what happened? Okay, so a few years go by. So they maybe achieved the direct military objective. But the fact is, of course, if you don't get at the root cause of the Palestinian violence, then you're obviously not going to solve for it. So
the root cause of Palestinian violence is the Jewish presence in Israel. So,
well, no, the hold
way,
on, hold
way
on.
To end that,
hold
I guess.
Hold on, hold on. I disagree with that.
Yeah. Corner, let him finish, hold please. On.
Go ahead.
The root cause, at least in the 56 case, was Palestinians believed they did not lose the right to live in Palestine just because they were violently ethnically cleansed from it. And certainly 7 years later, So that has nothing to do with there being a Jewish state. It just means I have a right to live in my home, the home that I was ethnically cleansed from. The same thing happened, by the way, in the 1980s. In 1982, Israel decides, you know, it's had enough of these terrorist attacks from the PLO, you know, and the PLO is based in Beirut. And at the time, go back to Israeli military statements made at the time, we are going to eradicate the PLO. We're going to destroy the PLO ability to attack us. What happens? They invade Beirut. They slaughter thousands of Palestinians and thousands of Lebanese. And what happened in response? Okay, they kicked out the PLO from Beirut. Great job. Great work. What happened in response? They occupied southern Lebanon for 20 years in order to prevent the PLO from coming back. And what did they get in return? They got a new movement carrying a new flag with a new supporter, and that was Hezbollah, backed by Iran, which is today the most formidable military adversary and is backed by an even more formidable military power. And so again, same thing happened. Israel came in with this idea that we're going to eradicate violent resistance, and they actually exacerbated it. And basically the same thing I would say has been true over the past 16 years, which is, again, in that first conflict in 2008, there were Israeli leaders at the time saying we were going to eradicate Hamas. Again, that obviously failed as well. So I think the basic point here is that if you do not get at the underlying cause of Palestinian anger, which is ethnic cleansing in 48, which is 56 years of occupation and apartheid and 16 years of siege, if you do not deal with those issues, it doesn't matter how many Hamas militants you kill. It doesn't matter how much of the Hamas tunnel network you destroy. You will get more Palestinian violence. And the fact that Israelis don't realize that you have to get at the underlying issues is the fundamental problem here. They would rather live in a state of perpetual war to one in which they have to make real concessions to Palestinians. And that, I think, is the fundamental issue.
Yeah, well, Zach, you're naive if you think that Jews will find safety as a minority in a Palestinian state. Perhaps that was possible in the 1920s. I don't think it ever was. It's certainly not possible today. You know, it's interesting that you say that there was like this, cycle of violence in 16 years. Israel had started a form of diplomatic outreach to Hamas. And I don't believe that Israel was involved in a direct conflict with Hamas since maybe as late as 2014, probably a little bit later than that. But the last two rounds of fighting, 2022, 2021, I guess the third one in 2019, was against Islamic Jihad and was not against Hamas. Israel was coming to a sort of diplomatic truce with Hamas. They had let in money from Qatar. A record number of Palestinian laborers from Gaza were allowed in order to work and to bring money and dignity to their families. And this all blew up in Israel's face. I mean, it's been revealed that many of those laborers provide critical intelligence information for Palestinian or Gazan fighters who would later emerge
out of
tunnels and break down.
Where did you see that reporting? Where did you see that reporting?
Let me finish, please.
That's misinformation. I have looked into that and I've never seen any serious reporting to that effect. So I'm just correcting factually inaccurate statements, but keep going.
So Hamas bragged about this themselves, that they had played Israel for a fool, that they had played Netanyahu for a fool, that Netanyahu thought that he could buy off the Palestinian resistance with foreign money and with labor permits. You know, the Palestinians, and you know, you say, oh, Israel could never find peace through military acts and through violence. I find that very ironic coming from someone with a PhD, you know, something of a historian of Palestine, when the entire slogan of the last 100 years of the Palestinian people has been armed resistance to take the land. And armed resistance against Israel has led to progressively worse and worse and worse consequences. So if you're going to be consistent, at least call for peace on the other side.
When did I ever call for military resistance?
Well, you certainly didn't condemn Hamas. You haven't said that Hamas should surrender. I mean, again, you don't justify, but you do explain. And Hamas and the Palestinians do not see any of this as a cycle of violence. They don't see it as a wheel going around and around where they attack Israel and Israel attacks back. But they see this as an arc of violence, an arc that ends in the final defeat, humiliation of the Jews, and the liquidation of the settler colonial population in Israel.
But Zach, let me just say one thing, if you don't mind me jumping in, because I just want to address a couple points you just made specifically about my beliefs, which is that I would say the same thing applies to Palestinian militant resistance as applies to Israel's response to Palestinian resistance, which is that the more Palestinians resort to force and violence, I think the worse off they get.
But that hasn't been your message. Your message has not been that. Your message has been to defend, to encourage, to say it's okay, Palestinians, we understand your violence. Palestinian violence leads nowhere. And if you want to call this a genocide, go ahead and call it a genocide. It isn't. But what this is a suicide. It's the suicide of Gaza by the resistance. Things only get worse every time that Palestinians pick up sword against Israel. And it's very sad to say, but this is the reality that Gazans have chosen for themselves. Now, I don't think that Israel should target civilians. I don't know how you could ever prove that, again, given that all of Gaza is basically a Hamas military base.
Hold on, I wouldn't say that
if I was an Israeli leader, but certainly there is a moral culpability here on the part of the Palestinians. This is what they have chosen, and this is consistent, brutally consistent with a 100-year history of armed resistance against settler colonialism.
The reason I think militant resistance backfires when Palestinians employ it is because the Palestinians are in a state of a powerlessness relative to Israel. And in order for them to gain leverage against Israel, they need international support. They need more powerful states to apply pressure to Israel. And they lose that support when they resort to a violent resistance, even if it is legal under the laws
of war. They gain support. Now, look at all of the rallies around the world. Look at the massive rally in Washington, D.C., and in London, and in Paris, even though the French made it legal. The Palestinians see that and they say, we're winning.
I mean, okay.
The arc of history is bending closer and closer.
Corner, let Foster finish.
The broader point I want to make here is that I think from the Palestinian point of view, it doesn't seem to really matter whether they pursue violent resistance or whether they pursue nonviolent resistance. In either way, the result is more land confiscations, more settlements, more apartheid-only roads, more home demolitions, more arrests, more mass detainments, more expulsions, more ethnic cleansing. More Israeli bombs, more indiscriminate slaughter. And I think if you realize that the Palestinians, again, regardless of what format they resist in, and let's recall, you know, first there was a first intifada that was nonviolent. They were slaughtered in response to that. Then they signed Oslo, and as a result of that, they got twice as many Israeli settlements, and the half of the West Bank and Gaza was in a period of total shutdown and lockdown for 5 years. And you know, and they got 70% unemployment rate in Gaza in 95 and 96 and 97 after they had engaged in this peace process, right? And then then you have the nonviolent protests in the early 2000s and Bilin and Nal'in and Nabi Saleh. And what happened in response? The Israeli military slaughtered nonviolent protesters. And then they got the Gaza March of Return in 2018. And what happened after that? They got slaughtered in the hundreds. And then you had BDS, you know, the most nonviolent movement possible, which is dedicated to nonviolence. And what did you get in response? The leader, Omar Barghouti, he was threatened with a displacement. They threatened to revoke his Palestinian ID, his East Jerusalem ID card, and they called leaders of the BDS movement anti-Semitic. So when Palestinians resort to nonviolence, they're slaughtered. Their IDs are taken away. They are put in jail. They are called anti-Semitic. When Palestinians resort to violence, same thing happens. They're slaughtered in response. They are displaced in response. The problem is not what type of resistance Palestinians pursue. It is their very existence. Because a state that defines itself as Jewish inherently considers non-Jews and especially Palestinians as a threat to their existence because they have a pulse. Because the fact that the pulse is Palestinian is the problem. They are a demographic threat by their very existence. And that's the fundamental problem here. It's that when you consider millions of people who you live next to as a security threat and as a demographic threat because they are living and breathing, because they inhale oxygen, then you're going to lead to a situation of perpetual war. And until Israelis abandon this idea that they can have a Jewish state in a land that is mostly non-Jewish, we're going to be in a state of perpetual war.
So if I may chime in again, because I actually think this is exactly where the conversation needs to be. On what Palestinians can do and what Israel can do. And I think where Palestinian resistance has gone wrong, I think there's two. One is the intention of the resistance, right? So their goal has not been, what their goal has been primarily has been to end Israel's existence, which is an absolute non-starter for the overwhelming majority of Jews living on the land, because they view Israel ceasing to exist as their death. Jews will not consent to something that will kill them. They would rather be called racist. They would rather be called an apartheid state and rather be isolated internationally and hated than be dead. So if the intention of resistance is a non-starter for those who hold all the power, it's not going to go anywhere, whether that's done through violent or non-violent means. Secondly, the primary means of resistance for Palestinians has been violent. It's true there have been attempts at nonviolent resistance, but if we compare to resistance movements in apartheid South Africa or in colonized India or the American Civil Rights Movement, there was violence in all those places, but it was primarily nonviolent. And that is why those, at least in the case of South Africa, why they were more comfortable with creating a system of equality, because they didn't feel like equality would cause them to die. And sure, it ended up being a disaster, and whites are fleeing South Africa now because that solution of everybody, two populations that were in conflict living together, actually didn't work out because it wasn't done with a long enough reconciliation process and it was just done too soon. And that's with the population that wasn't nearly as violent in their means of resistance as the Palestinian population has been, right? So if Palestinians want to be more effective in their resistance, they need an intention, a goal that Israelis can agree with. And there's many that Israelis will agree with: bettering their conditions, having self-determination over part of the land, having right of return to part of the land, improving the conditions of Palestinian citizens of Israel. All of these are things that Jewish Israelis will consent to. But if the intention is destroying Israel, it's a non-starter. It doesn't matter what your resistance will be. It's just not going to work. Now, on the Israeli side, because Zach, I agree with you. We say defeating Hamas isn't enough if we don't deal with the root cause of the pain of the Palestinians. I agree. So again, this does come with compromises. A lot of the pain comes from Israel actually existing. So Palestinians are going to need to come to terms with the fact that Israel will remain to exist. But what can Israel actually do to make it more tolerable and acceptable and palatable to the Palestinians? There's a lot. There's a shit ton. And this is where many Israelis lack in imagination. You ask Israelis, what can we do differently? They say, nothing. We've done it all. And that's where they're entirely wrong. So let's just talk about a few things. And I'm just one person. I'm sure if we actually sit and brainstorm it, we can come up with a lot more. For example, there's currently a military occupation of the West Bank. As long as some security apparatus is needed in the West Bank, it should be done by a civilian police force, not a military force, not 18 to 20-year-olds. They should be highly trained. They should speak Arabic. They should treat Palestinians with dignity and respect. And they should actually be viewed as Palestinians, as their protectors, not their oppressors. And if there's an abuse of power, which is quite prevalent, they should be held accountable, right? There's all these videos coming out of these soldiers abusing Palestinian prisoners. They should be in jail for that. If you abuse a Palestinian prisoner, if you abuse your power as a soldier, as a civilian peace force, go to jail, straight up. That is one way where we could really improve the conditions of Palestinians. We should work to integrate our economies as best as possible. We should orient the Israeli population towards peace by teaching them Palestinian history, teaching them about the Nakba, teaching them Arabic, right? These are all things that could help. So there's a lot we could do, but we need to agree on doing things that aren't going to put Jews in direct danger, because that's just a non-starter, and we're just going to have another 100 years of deterioration, because it's a request that's not really viable for those who hold the power.
But and yeah, again, the Palestinians have not fought and died for 100 years so that the Israeli Defense Force could be replaced with the Israeli civilian force in the West Bank. They fought and died so they could reclaim their land, Palestine. As the chant goes, we don't want two states. We want all of it. Now, Foster has claimed that Palestinians are nonviolent. This is a popular myth. I'll just ask this. If Palestinians are really not only nonviolent, but anti-violent, where are the not-in-my-name protests against Hamas's violence? I'm not saying now. I understand a lot of Palestinians have died now. But on October 7th, it was clear that Hamas had inflicted a terrible atrocity. Where were the people in Gaza standing on corners and saying, not in our name? This is un-Islamic. Islamic values say that, you know, all people are equal and that you shouldn't go into children's bedrooms and shoot them while they're hiding under the covers underneath the bed. Where were those protests? They weren't in Gaza. And you say, well, you know, they couldn't do that or Hamas would kill them. They weren't in the West Bank. They weren't in Cairo. They weren't in Algeria. They weren't in any of the major European capitals with large Muslim populations. Look at how Jews have reacted to Israel's actions. And the death total, right? With all protests that shut down. So Palestinians are fighting for the whole land. Is BDS nonviolent? You know, look, every violent movement has a nonviolent wing. I mean, for every Eichmann, there was a Goebbels. And I think when Palestinians say that we want all of it, we should take that at face value. There is nothing that we can give them so long as we remain in the land.
I think the correct analogy here to answer the question of like, why are there no Palestinians protesting Hamas after October 7th? I think, first of all,
the attack, not Hamas, the attack on October 7th.
I think almost every single respectable commentator, be them Palestinian or Israeli or otherwise, I'm familiar with, has come out and stated the acts of October 7th were horrendous and that we condemn them. I think that the better question is, if you zoom out, you know, and let me just to provide a little bit more context here. You know, I think, you know, I think an appropriate analogy here would be if I'm a baby or I'm a kid and an adult has their foot over my neck and I can barely breathe, right? I'm every day at risk of dying because I don't have enough air coming through my esophages. And then one day, after years and years of barely being able to breathe, I grab a knife and stab the person's foot. Okay, now I can finally breathe for like 3 seconds. And then you ask that kid on the ground, you ask his friends or her friends, you know, how come you didn't criticize him for stabbing that person's leg? You know, that's kind of what's happening here, right? If you zoom out and understand the bigger picture, the context, the framing, how we got to where we got to today, right? You have a military superpower. You have the world's 10th largest army, a nuclear power that has been occupying for 56 years Gaza and has been besieging them for 16 years and has slaughtered thousands of them over the past 16 years in 5 different wars, the vast majority of those killed innocent. So the analogy is apt. You're asking now, where are the people condemning them?
Yeah, where are they?
Where were they condemning Israel? Where is the Israeli Gandhi? Where is an Israeli nonviolent movement that says...
They're in Tel Aviv. They're in Penn Station.
Where are they now? They're calling for genocide.
There are protests.
They're getting on Israeli TV and calling for genocide. They're saying there's no difference between a civilian and a militant in Gaza. They're calling for the mass indiscriminate slaughter of Palestinians. That's where the liberals are in Tel Aviv right now. I mean, you have a whole society that has been almost brainwashed into supporting a genocidal slaughter. It's totally insane. And you're complaining, why aren't people criticizing Hamas? Why aren't Israelis criticizing the Israeli military?
Because it's very strange, and some people might be wondering, if your picture is true, and Israel is this monstrous power, and not even, but let's say just a superpower, forget about monstrous, sorry. If Israel is the adult, and the Gazans are the toddlers, and toddlers obviously have no chance physically against an adult, then why not just give up? I mean, isn't that usually what happens when you're against a overwhelming power? Because if you zoom out to the context and the frame through which the Palestinians see things and through which Hamas sees things, it's obvious that it's actually Israel that's the small power. I mean, if you read Hamas's charter, whether it's vile 1988 or it's refurbished 2017 charter, they say that the Palestinians are the heart of the Arab and Muslim world. There are something like 350, 400 million Arabs against 7 million Jews. You total the land mass of all Arab countries, it certainly is much more. And then you have massive countries, Turkey, 80 million, Iran, 80 million, Pakistan, 300 million, 1.8 billion Muslims facing down a tiny outpost of hated Jews. And it's very interesting that the left is always talking about Jewish strength, because if you read a lot of Palestinian and Muslim commentators, you will find a very different sort of tone taken. I remember a post by Yosef Menayer who said that, you know, Israel has never really won a war since 1967, and they only won that by a surprise attack. Now, this is just not true. But what it touches upon is an idea that's very deep in the Muslim psyche, an idea that is strange to Western ears because it's a stereotype of Jews that doesn't exist. But in the Muslim conception of the Jews, Jews are a weak and effeminate people. And it makes little sense how Jews could be so strong. And this is part of where the colonial myth enters. The only way that Israel is able to survive against, you know, feminine, pathetic, weak Jews, against the strong, manly Muslims, is because of American power and American support. And all the Palestinians need to do is cut off that support, and then Israel will wither. So your view of the conflict, Zach, I think is very Jewish. It's very leftist. It's very Western, and you're leaving out two dimensions. I spoke before about the power game that goes on. You don't believe in power, which is interesting because my cats believe in power. The idea of power is that people fight over physical resources in the world. You say no, and this is the basis of liberalism, that we need law and we need government and a monopoly on power in order to stop people from fighting each other. You say no. So long as you give the indigenous people everything they want, they'll never harm you. This idea has no pedigree, has no basis in the liberal canon, and it's not a liberal idea, it's a racial ideal. I digress. You also refuse to see it from a religious frame, that part of this is a religious war.
Certainly.
That an Islamic group is fighting an Islamic battle, and that it can only end, not when they're living together with the Jews and their daughters are dating our sons, but when the Jews are humiliated and destroyed.
I mean, you're certainly correct that the fight over Palestine has evolved into increasingly into a religious war, in the sense that the most violent and the most extremes on both sides, Hamas and Islamic Jihad on the Palestinian side, and the Israeli military, which has increasingly come to be dominated by religious soldiers, as well as the Israeli settlers, who are the violent ones, or essentially all religious. I mean, increasingly, that is what the conflict has become, but that's certainly not how we got here.
I want to, your boot on the neck analogy. I actually want to build on that analogy and make it more accurate, I would say. So you have two kids. One is Israel, one's Palestine. Let's say the kid that is Israel betrayed Palestine. Maybe he slept with Palestine's girlfriend. He's in the wrong, right? That's fucked up. So Palestine is furious and tries to kill the kid that is Israel in response. So then Israel's father steps in and puts his boot on Palestine's neck to stop him from killing his child and keeps the boot on the neck as long as Palestine is destined to kill his child. That is probably a more fair analogy because the boot on the neck doesn't exist for no reason. It exists as a means of defense. And if it was for no reason, you're shaking your head, but let's look at most policy that's harming Palestinians. Some of it is rooted in religious ideology, like expansion of settlements, right? But most of the most harmful policies is rooted in defense. Now, let's just look at something that imagine an alternate reality where Hamas gets elected in 2006. Israel responds with a siege because they view Hamas as a terrorist organization whose charter says to destroy Israel. But Hamas says, you know what? We want to build a beautiful life for Palestinians. So instead of investing all this money into weapons and tunnels, let's invest it in infrastructure. Let's build Gaza to make it this beautiful city. And let's just stop the fight against Israel. Let's just build Gaza and make it this beautiful Palestine. That actually ultimately would end the siege because the siege doesn't exist out of malice. It exists so Hamas can't strike Israel. And just one example of the effectiveness of a siege, why do you think Hezbollah is so much more powerful and their military capabilities to kill Israelis is so much greater? It's because Lebanon's not under siege. They have free reins to import whatever they want. And that's why if we have war with Hezbollah, there's going to be thousands of Israeli civilian deaths just from rocket fire. The siege on Gaza is simply to keep Jews safe. And of course, Israel is going to prioritize the safety of their people over the well-being of another population. So those who care about Palestinians, as I do, as I know you do as well, Foster, should be asking these questions as well. Let's actually elevate the lives of Palestinians significantly. And the best way to do that is to invest in Palestinians and not invest into killing Jews. Right. And I feel like we're really missing this. We're really missing this in our conversation for how we can improve the lives of Palestinians.
I think you both raise a really critical point here, which is that from the Israeli point of view, the only thing that matters is the security of Israelis. And I think if you understand that basic premise, that it doesn't matter how many Palestinians need to die to save one Israeli Jew, and maybe even one Israeli Muslim. But it basically doesn't really matter what the cost will be on Palestinians because it's our security that matters most. I think you've really gone a long way to understanding really the core issue here, which is that Jews fundamentally believe that a Jewish life is worth more than a Palestinian life. And if you understand that, you understand Oslo, you understand 2007 siege on Gaza, and you understand really the entire history of the entire conflict. And how is it, so let's actually try just say a bit more about that. I mean, really the framework of Oslo was Israel is both the party to the agreement, and it is also the enforcer of the agreement, right? There's no police that says, let me see who's, you know, are the Israelis and the Palestinians both, holding their side of the agreement? No. Israel is the party to the agreement, but they're also the ones deciding, upholding the agreement. Are both sides, doing? And so, and that's why during the 90s, whenever there was a question of, do I lock down the West Bank and Gaza, inflict tremendous suffering on the Palestinians? Or do I allow Palestinians some self-rule and some autonomy and some basic human rights, freedom of movement, freedom of expression? So whenever those two things came in conflict, you can almost be certain that Israel is going to choose its own security first.
Yeah.
And so really what you're saying is my life matters more than yours. And when that's your starting point, you will never have peace with the Palestinians. Well, you need the starting point needs to be we are equal. And as soon as you say we are equal, everything changes.
Oslo thinks that way. What country?
That's the starting point of every country in the world. They're gonna prefer their citizens over.
But Palestinians are in Israel. They're being controlled, but they're not like a separate entity in a separate state. They are within the border of the control of the state of Israel.
Well, let's talk about Gaza, for example. Gaza was a clear example. We disengaged. We pulled all our citizens. Yeah. All our citizens out of Gaza. It was highly controversial. It was an opportunity for Gaza to rise up and thrive. Hamas was elected. And I actually think Israel made a mistake. I think the siege should have only been implemented after the first rocket strike. I agree that Israel should have had a measure of good faith in addition to the disengagement. Should have said, okay, Hamas was elected. Let's try to work with them. Let's give them an opportunity. Instead, doing an automatic.
Israel never ended the occupation of Gaza.
Yes,
not even for one minute.
You simply changed the definition of occupation. You simply move the goalpost because Palestinian violence always needs an explanation. It can't just be that Palestinians aren't happy with peace, even though they've rejected peace since 1937. Even when they say over and over again, we won't be happy with two states. We want the whole thing. I mean, it's as much of a story as it is of denial. How many times can people tell you the same thing until you start saying it yourself, Zach?
I think the analogy here with Gaza would be if you're controlling a prison and your prison guards are in the halls, they're like manning the different gates and different doors and different hallways, and then you said, we're getting a lot of these prisoners seem to be, causing problems. Why don't we just withdraw our soldiers to the perimeter of the prison, control all the entry points and the exit points, control what's under the prison and what's over the prison, control what gets into the prison and what gets out of the prison. But you know what? Who can decide how much food each prisoner gets, and who can decide whether or not the prisoners are allowed into the courtyard? We'll give one or two or three prisoners the right to do that. And that's the analogy here. And so if you're of the belief that in the case of the prison, that's actually giving up control of the prison. I mean, that's kind of the argument you're making, Adar.
I mean, we didn't even have you say we have control of Gaza. Then why do we need to send all these soldiers in if we have control? I mean, I agree. We have airspace control.
Well,
we control what's in out. But how we don't have a monopoly of force inside of Gaza. In fact, on the morning of the 7th, we didn't even have a monopoly of force on the area surrounding Gaza. And you guys had always promised that all Palestinians wanted to do was break free from the fence and taste the most delicious air of freedom. Right. That, we heard from Joy Reid that Gaza is 50% children. So, Palestinians are going to break through the fence with their kids and they're going to go and have a pajama party with Israelis. We saw what happened when the fence was down. It's not a prison fence. It is a fence put up for our protection from a hostile population that does not accept our existence. And look, in Oslo, you never give credit to Israeli Jews. And I know that Israeli Jews are really annoying, and there's a ton of racism in Israel. But the Israeli left recognized that both morally and politically, it was wrong to hold Palestinians inside of the West Bank. It was wrong to do that, and that we shouldn't do that. And that we need a Palestinian partner to give up the land for two reasons. One, because it's wrong. And if that doesn't convince you, then two, the belief was that if we keep holding on to it, the world is going to place us in a boycott and destroy us. And during the Oslo years, and mistakes were made, and things happened, but during the Oslo years, peace was offered. And look how many countries Israel has made peace with. You say, Israel doesn't want peace. We made peace with Egypt. We made peace with Jordan. There were talks for peace with Syria, Morocco, Bahrain, the UAE. It was about to be Saudi Arabia. In fact, part of the reason that Hamas attacked was it didn't want Israel to make peace with another Arab country, because most of the Arab states have moved on from the revanchist fantasy of the Palestinians to reclaim their land. And if Palestinians have never actually tried peace, and it's incredible that you say that they have. And this whole fantasy that, they're just like a child with an adult on their neck. It's so self-destructive. It's so untrue, and it's so self-destructive.
I mean,
it's obviously disproven by the events of the past. Because Gaza today, as bad as Gaza was on October 6th, it is far worse today.
I mean,
Foster, before you chime in, and we are on an hour and a half, so chat, start asking questions. We'll do a few questions. I just want to correct something. I made a small error, so I want to correct it. I said that after Hamas was elected, that's when the siege began. So actually the siege began with the disengagement, which is certainly, Israelis view the disengagement as an act of good faith. We gave them an opportunity. But for that to be a true opportunity, it should have been without a siege. So so this kind of just pokes a little bit hole in the narrative that we gave them a full opportunity to just build this flourishing society. They should have had an opportunity with no siege to build Gaza as this beautiful city, this beautiful state even. And if there was rocket fire, that could have justified a siege, but we preempted the siege, which, makes a much weaker case to the fact that we gave them a true opportunity. So I just want to put that out there.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're getting it. I mean, thank you for that correction, Adar. And I think, you know, again, I like this retort to analogies because I think that really helps people understand the nature of Israel's peace offers over the years. And if you think about even kind of the framework of Oslo of like, oh, wow, this is, you know, the promise of peace. We're coming to the negotiation table. The framework was Palestinians can have small autonomy within cantons that are controlled by Israel. Right. So Oslo was, we're going to engage in peace negotiations under the condition that we still have total control over these little enclaves that we're giving you self-rule within. It's actually very similar to what's happening in Gaza now. You know, right? So in 93, Yasser Arafat now has control of Jericho and Gaza. But again, he doesn't have control over the maritime coastline. He doesn't have control of who enters and exits Jericho. Who enters and exits Gaza. Israel has control over that. And the same was true as Israel transferred more self-rule, more control over to then Hebron, you know, in 95, and then it transfers control over to Jenin and Nablus and Ramallah and all the other Palestinian urban population centers. But at any moment in time, Israel locks them all down, and it did throughout the course of the 90s. But again, always that. So in other words, Israel decides how much freedom Palestinians get, how much self-rule they actually get. So again, and then in 2000s, it continued. You know, long after the Camp David and Taba broke down in 2000, negotiations continued. But again, it was Palestinians traveling from Ramallah to Tel Aviv to take place in the negotiations. And every time they travel, they're stopped at a checkpoint. It's 19-year-old Israeli military personnel barraging and Palestinian senior officials at checkpoints, holding them, keeping them in a car, preventing them from leaving. 2 hours, they're sitting at a checkpoint waiting to get to the negotiation table. And these were fair negotiations? There was never anything fair about any of the negotiations because, again, Israel never treated Palestinians as equals. They always treated them as second-class citizens. And that's true in Israel today. That's true of the Palestinian negotiating team throughout the 90s and throughout the 2000s. And, of course, it's true in Gaza today. Israel matters first. Jews matter first. Our security is what matters. And as long as that's your attitude, that we are unwilling to engage with our partners as equals, that we will always engage with them as superiors, you will be destined to a life of war. And it's like, why do Israelis want that? I don't know. Why do you want the next October 7th is going to be 10 times worse? You know, and maybe it'll take 5 years or 10 years.
Good senses make good neighbors. You can come to an agreement with your neighbor without treating them as equal. I hope you don't treat your wife like you treat the wife of your neighbor. That would maybe make for some fun drama. But we don't need to see them.
You're not neighbors. You're bedfellows.
We never trusted them because they were never intent on living in peace. And there were documents already circulating in the Palestinian Authority in the 1970s that spoke of not a two-state solution, but a two-stage solution. First, agree to peace with Israel now, and when the terms are favorable, wage war. And you know where you can really see this, that Palestinians never wanted peace? You can see it in the Palestinian intellectual community. And there are lots of names, Yosef Menayer, Diana Butu, Mohammed El Kurt. I could go on. I have never, as a lover of ideas and somebody who reads widely, I have never encountered a group of people with less intellectual diversity than Palestinian Americans and Europeans writing in English. The amount of diversity within a single Israeli party, Likud, Jewish Power, Labor, is greater. Within a single Jewish party, is greater than the entire spectrum of American Palestinian thought. Palestinians are convinced of their infinite victimhood.
Do you want to take some questions from the chat?
And I actually want to add more to my correction. Thank you, chat, for pointing this out. Actually, rocket fire began in 2001 prior to the disengagement, which could very well, in Israel's eyes, justify siege. That said, I still think a good faith measure would have been a fresh start to disengage, no siege, And it very well would have resulted in rocket fire, let's be honest. But then at the very least, we could have said that we tried without any restrictions whatsoever, and it failed.
To Beth M., has Zach F. ever been in Israel? We have a picture. I don't know if you showed it, but me and Zach went out in Tel Aviv. We had a great time. We drank a lot. He's been in Israel with me and numerous other times in Israel, the West Bank, and I believe Gaza, though I don't want to speak to for him. You've been to Gaza too?
Yes, I've been to Israel. I've lived in Israel for many years. I've been to Gaza multiple times. I've been more or less everywhere in Israel and Palestine.
And the Zacks met through this channel. So, you know, look at us just creating friendships one live stream at a time.
I didn't say they weren't intelligent, very good writers, better writers and communicators than me. I said that this is the range of their thought. This.
Yeah, I want to actually reply to Zohar's question right here.
Yeah, real quick. We're gonna take questions. We're gonna prioritize members, and we're gonna prioritize super chats in case you want to hit us with a super chat. Yeah, Zach, take it away.
I actually love this idea. I think that one of the best responses to October 7th and, you know, the aftermath of October 7th should have been, we need to hold all war criminals to account for what has happened since October 7th. That includes the Hamas senior leadership that carried out this grotesque act of violence and massacre. And that includes the entire Israeli political leadership and military leadership that has carried out mass indiscriminate slaughter of 10,000 Palestinians. So I would love that. I think that is an excellent way, a way to frame how, you know, to just talk about what is going on, which is that we have war criminals who are continuing their crimes as we speak in real time. But no one's talking about bringing all these people to justice. And I think part of the reason is because both sides are kind of so invested in their own narratives that to actually come forward and say, we need to try these Hamas criminals in court and we need to try these Israeli criminals in court, that they are both criminals and they are both committing heinous acts of violence and that in violation of the laws of war. They're violating laws of proportionality. They're violating laws of distinction. And we need to hold them all to account. And I think that is a way, I think, actually, that we can move forward together. If we believe that we should be living in a civilized world that embraces laws of war, then we should all be calling for that right now. So, Zohar, thank you for that question.
I could get behind that as well. Cool. We have a question from member Yigal Kamel. What do you think is an initial good faith step Israel can take towards Palestinian freedom that does not put Israelis in further danger? So I responded to this like 20 minutes ago, but Zach's, feel free to have a take on it.
I think, again, like I said, I think Hamas needs to cease the rocket attacks and needs to release the hostages. Again, both of which are crimes of war. Just as Israel needs to stop dropping bombs and end the siege and blockade immediately. I would call for all of those things right now. That's what both sides need to do. It's why are we isolating out what the Palestinians need to do? No, both Israelis and Palestinian political leaders in Tel Aviv and in Gaza need to end the criminal acts immediately. I mean, that's obvious.
Whether true or not, Israelis feel that they are facing an existential threat. Another thing you didn't talk about in almost 2 hours now, Zach, is the pathology of Israelis based on our history. And based on Jewish history, that we've, you know, been the ultimate victim of the human story, whether it's true or not true. But that is what Israelis are thinking about now. How do we get security? And security will come from the destruction of Hamas.
I mean, look, as long as we're returning to this framing of we're the forever victim and the only thing that matters is our security, we will continue to live in a state of perpetual war.
The same can be said for the Palestinians. When I say something about Jews, you say, oh, that's so terrible, it's no good, it's counterproductive. Then you say the same thing in the Palestinian frame. That's my point.
When did I say Palestinian security is the only thing that matters? Hold on.
Israel after 10 years.
When did I ever say that's the only thing that matters? I've never said that. I'm calling these Palestinian leaders of Hamas criminals. I never said the only thing that matters is Palestinian security. Look, no, what I'm saying is the frame
today,
that the only thing that matters
should
is
let in water and food and medicine. I think Yoav.
Yeah. Let's go on to the next one. First of all, Yoav, thank you for that £1 super chat. You kind British chap. I very much appreciate it. Where's Yoav's question? I can't find it.
It was for Zach F.
I think. It's right after. It's right after the 1,000.
Zach F. If you acknowledge Jews are colonizers, why is it so difficult to agree and understand that many Palestinians want to kick out the colonizers like every native in history?
Well, first of all, I would have never, have never, and never would call for uprooting Israeli citizens from the state of Israel. When did I ever call for that? No, that's criminal. You don't.
Well, no, what I think he's saying is why can't you acknowledge that if Palestinians view Israelis as colonizers, what do you do with colonizers? You send them home, right? This whole go back to Europe, go back where you came from is quite common. You know,
I'm not aware of any serious Palestinian intellectuals or serious Palestinian commentators or supporters or empathizers with the Palestinians. Can you name a single person that is calling for Israelis to go back to Morocco or Algeria or Poland?
From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free.
Hold on, but Zach, that's not what that statement means.
I actually think Muhammad El Kurd said that colonizers need to leave, and he includes Jews.
Yeah, they asked him.
Listen, I'm not here to defend the statements of other individuals.
But you were until you heard them.
I'm just saying I've never heard anyone say that. That's what I said.
Al Kurd was asked, what will happen to the Jews after Palestinians come back? And he said,
I don't care.
He said, I don't give a fuck. And Peter Beinart, who's, you know, on your camp and in denial, said that in no way does he want harm to come to the Jews.
I've never met Muhammad El Kurd. I don't know him personally. I barely follow things he says. Please do not associate me with the statements of other people who I've never met.
I don't think he was associating you. I think he was saying, isn't it important to acknowledge that this is the intention of many Palestinians? It's not just equality. It's retribution. It's to kick us out.
I'm a person who believes in the importance that all people, all parties to a conflict should abide by international law, okay? And according to international law, it is illegal it would be illegal for a Palestinian combatant to go to Israel and uproot a Israeli non-combatant. Because again, that violates the laws of distinction, which requires combatants in a war to distinguish between military and civilian targets. So if you're targeting an Israeli civilian, you are in violations of the law of war, and you should be tried for that, and you should be held accountable for your crimes.
Yeah.
I've stated that almost
since the
beginning of this conversation.
I don't understand looking – well, that was the whole point of the attacks on October 7th. Joseph Mossad, a particularly violent Palestinian commentator, he said the point was to uproot the settler colonial communities. He's a professor at Columbia. But, you know, I just didn't see anything in the October 7th attack that to me suggested that Palestinians wanted to live with me or my people in peace. I guess you interpret that differently. You interpret the cries of Allahu Akbar to the sites of dead Jewish children as a chant for peace and coexistence.
But Zach, hold on.
I interpreted it.
I've been very clear since the beginning. I mean, what I just said multiple times was that I have no lost love for criminals, that I reject the violations of the laws of war that we've seen on the part of Hamas. I've said that now probably 5 times on this pod. So please don't accuse me of having sympathy for criminals.
I'm not accusing you. There's no,
you know, so look.
And Ben-Gvir, I mean, he's awful. He's the worst.
I mean, now, I think there are interesting.
Israel is a deeply racist society, and it's a question.
But can I also
it's a question of how much Judaism is involved in that racism? Let me go. I mean, that was where I was before October 7th.
I just want to address real quickly this, because anyway, it's in the chat right now, this From the River to the Sea here, because you know, you stated that was tantamount to pushing Jews, to ethnically cleansing Jews from Israel.
Yes,
and I think this is a really unfortunate that this slogan has been so grotesquely misinterpreted by so many people to such a point that people are losing their jobs. I mean, Mark Lamon lost his CNN job because of this, and it's even more toxic right now. I mean, we have whole Twitter threads of dozens of people being, you know, fired or denied or all kinds of things because of saying this one statement. I think, in my view, again, this statement means different things to different people. But I think the most literal reading is that a Palestinian, whether they're living in Gaza or whether they're living in the West Bank or Jerusalem or Israel proper, has a right to be free. That's what it means. Sure. And what does it mean, a right to be free? It means to have a right to freedom of political expression, the right to vote, the right to freedom of movement. A literal reading of that expression is a beautiful thing. It's saying people, no matter whether they're living in under siege in Gaza, or whether under apartheid and occupation in the West Bank, or whether they're living as second-class citizens in Israel, that they should be free and they should have the right to vote and freedom of movement, freedom of expression.
Slogan.
I mean, the only way that's the literal reading. That's the literal reading of that phrase.
Is if the Palestinians were in power, and for a few hours on the morning of October 7th, they were in power, and we saw what they did with their freedom.
I think,
you know, of course, Rashid Tlaib is not going to say that. Oh, it means the destruction of Israel.
But it's the anti-colonial slogan. But you're making assumptions.
We have a precedent in Algeria, which the PLO based themselves off of. And in Algeria, the natives kicked out 1.5 million colonizing French. We know that Martin Luther King never came close to saying anything like from the river to the sea. You know, America will be free for the indigenous and African Americans. Certainly, there was that camp in South Africa. Real quick, I'm wrapping up 30 seconds. Certainly, there was that camp in South Africa, but it was shot down by Nelson Mandela, who said South Africa belongs to all who live in it, whites and blacks together. Palestinians have never made such a statement, not at least to my knowledge.
So on from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. I think this is how it's interpreted differently from each side. What those saying that quote, they're saying that Israel will cease to exist. They're not inherently saying Jews will be ethnically cleansed. Some who say that certainly would like for that to happen, but a charitable interpretation is from the river to the sea, there will be no Israel. Jews, most of them, see there being no Israel as a call for ethnic cleansing or genocide. And in practice, if Israel were to cease to exist and Jews were to remain on the land, that almost certainly would be the result. So you could say it's from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free is either malicious or naive. And that's really how most Jews are viewing it. Zach, I know you think that we could just dismantle the state. We could all live here under one state. And it'll be beautiful, but I don't see any reason to believe that won't be bloodier than any bloodshed we've seen on this land thus far. So obviously Jews are going to be resistant to it, but I do agree that we should be able to see a more charitable interpretation of it and not take it as inherently genocidal, but just inherently not wanting Israel to exist. It's just, Palestinians and those in the pro-Palestine camp need to understand what the destruction of Israel actually means to Jews and what we're quite confident will happen if Israel ceases to exist.
It's the Jews will not replace us of the Palestinians. We've heard it before. And one of the slogans of Zionism is it's better to be hated and to be than to be dead.
Where does it say any? I mean, again, this is, in my opinion, the Israeli interpretation of that expression really highlights and underlines the racist belief that Palestinians wake up and go to sleep every day thinking about how they can push the Jews into the sea. And that is fundamentally, I think, the basic problem here, again, which is that from the Israeli perspective, my security matters most because the only thing that Palestinians want to do is kill me. But again, that is not rooted in reality. That is rooted in your own disillusionment. And I think, again, like, there's nothing in that expression that implies whatsoever the end of Israel or destruction of Israel. It's entirely focused on freedom, which is a beautiful idea.
You think that people saying that slogan, actually some of them support a two-state solution? I don't know, man. I think generally speaking, if we were to poll those who say that quote, it's the dismantling of Israel. That's their position.
The phrase two-state solution should be deleted from the vocabulary of this conversation, because that is a disingenuous phrase, because there is a one state reality. There is no two state solution. There's a one state reality
currently. currently.
So, like,
yeah, no,
do but, they re- so they reject those. So you're saying they reject the one state reality that we live in?
No, what people saying that quote, if you ask them what their solution for the conflict is, they're not going to describe any solution that involves Israel existing as a Jewish state. Like, that's not the solution they're talking about. Like,
anyway, they're also not going to describe violence. They're not stupid.
Mean, right now, right. The Jewish state is an apartheid state. Of course, they're going to reject an apartheid state. The Jewish state controls the lives of 5 million Palestinians without allowing them the right to the vote for the government that controls their lives.
If you ask them, well, how do you feel about Jews having sovereignty over some of the land and they can actually control what happens on that land, and then Palestinians will have sovereignty over another piece of land, they'll be like, no, any form of Israel's existence is inherently anti-Palestinian. But, and that is a very common anti-Zionist position. I mean, that's not...
This idea that Jews should only have, but you're creating a false narrative and framework in which there is the plausibility that Jews are going to somehow give up some part of the land. But that's not in the cards right now, and it hasn't been for 20 years.
The fundamental problem and the fundamental framing is, how should Israel deal with neighbors who have never stopped attacking it and have never stopped believing in their ability to destroy it? You know, the Palestinians are very impressive people in that they've never given up their revolution. And look, even as hard as Israel is hitting Gaza now, Hamas continues to fight. It continues to send waves of rockets at the coastal area in Tel Aviv. It continues to send its brave young men, you know, to run into battle and die. The only analogy I can think of really in the 20th century is Mao's China. But what should Israel do given of people on its border who don't accept it in any arrangement? This is the fundamental conundrum. Now, I know that to varying degrees, Adar and my friend Zach don't accept that. But from our perspective, that has been proven. It's not that Palestinians are anything less than human. That isn't the point. Of course, we value ourselves more. How could we not? That's like every other country in the world.
I mean, I think you just...
One of the problems is that there hasn't been enough assimilation between the two sides. I mean, we as Jews are overly confident that just reading once a year in the Torah that all people were created in God's image is enough to actually believe that. It's not. It doesn't work that way. The way that you believe in the humanity of the other is to live with them, to go to school with them, to hang out with them. Yes, I saw a question. I do have Palestinian friends. I had some, you know, I don't want to call her a girlfriend, but an arrangement on and off for about 2 years.
Let's talk about your love life.
Me the other day, she said, "Oh, are you the anti-Zionist?" They said, "Don't you remember our conversations? Did I seem like I was the anti-Zionist?"
Guys, we should wrap. That was
my idea.
Let's do final thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, I just would underline the point I think I've made pretty consistently throughout this talk, which is like, as soon as Israelis are willing to engage with Palestinians as equal, there will be hope for a peaceful and a just future. Until then, I unfortunately would be very pessimistic and would arrive at the conclusion that these people wish for themselves a life of perpetual and never-ending violence, and I just hope they eventually come to the belief that Israelis and Palestinians are equal, and that's the final thing I'll say.
Thank you, Zach.
I said before that there is no solution. There are only things that are better and things that are worse. I thought that things really couldn't get much better than about it 6 months ago when we had this discussion. And I said that people need to understand that in the Middle East, things usually go backwards before they go forwards. And here we are. You know, Israel has been wounded grievously. The Palestinians are suffering enormously. And I hope that both peoples have learned their lesson and try to move on, though I have zero confidence that that will happen. So hopefully next year will be another year of status quo, because the alternative to status quo is not peace, but is war.
Thank you, Zach Horner. Zach Foster, I have a question, because based on the comments, someone's saying that they felt like you were teamed up on and constantly being attacked. Do you feel like that's what happened today?
Look, it's a heated debate. I mean, we're talking about a very tense and violent war being waged on 2.5 million innocent people, and we're taking different sides on that of that issue. So yeah, obviously it's going to be heated. I would expect that. I don't feel like you're treated unfairly.
He's at the Middle East conference. He'll have plenty of support over there. It'll be like.
No, do you feel like you were treated unfairly?
No, I always had a chance to speak up. It's not like I was shut down in silence. No. I mean, we obviously disagree. There's no question about that. But do I feel like I was treated unfairly? No.
Cool. Just wanted to check in.
Yeah.
Zach, thank you guys. Thank you, Otto. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you both. Looking forward to round six at some point, and then thank you both for the work that you both do.
Okay. Thanks a lot, guys.